Now, Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding present the CBS Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. And welcome to the Bob and Ray Show for another week, and a real happy day it is here in our studio.
Now, it's time to check on the whereabouts of Wally Ballou, who today has gone up to Connecticut to an antique factory. There to talk with the owner and manufacturer. So come in, please. Wally Ballou.
Ballou, here at the antique factory, which seems to be going at full tilt here today as we walk through period furniture of an old and bygone day. Mr. Fertnell, is that your name?
Fertnell, F-E-R-T-N-A-L-L, Fertnell.
I've never known a Fertnell before. You're probably the first Fertnell that I've ever come across.
Well, there are some other Fertnells here in town. There are, I don't know, I imagine there are Fertnells somewhere else in the country, and I would assume they're all relatives.
Kind of an antique name, in other words. And
Randolph Fertnell came over here many, many years ago.
Uh-huh.
It's 1911.
Tell me this, what are you manufacturing most here today? I don't...
We're making 16th century colonial antiques here now. Old beds, old tables and chairs, closets.
That's a television cabinet there, isn't it?
What?
Is that a television cabinet?
That's right, yes.
Well, is it authentic antique, or...?
Yes, not, well, it's reproduction. But we won't tell anybody that when we sell.
In other words, you sell these for the real thing.
Oh, sure. It's awfully hard. We put our own scratches on it, and we wax it.
We wax it, I think.
Yes, we do. And we ship them out.
How about these wormholes in here? How do you create the, simulate the effect of wormholes in the wood?
We use screwdrivers. We also use little drills. And sometimes if we can find a good termite, we'll put them to work on a piece of wood.
Uh-huh. And these pieces, I understand, bring a pretty good price.
You yes. Oh, yes. There are, you know, antique fanciers who will pay quite a bit of money for one of these phonies.
Uh-huh. And without even knowing that it's not the original piece.
No, but they have just as much enjoyment as though George Washington had actually sat on the chair.
Well, now, for instance, this television cabinet, do you tell people that this goes back to 1600, 1700?
No, we don't. We don't mention it at all.
Has anybody ever raised the point that they didn't have television back then?
Yes, but we say that it was... when the older folks used it, it was to keep dishes in or something like that. And we have hired four gentlemen to actually sleep in the bed one night or to sit on a chair or to look in the mirror or some such. We have a Benjamin Franklin working for us. We have a George Washington. We have a James Madison. And we have a Roland E. Fleuring.
What'd you do, buy up Goodson Todman's old file?
What do you mean?
The name's the same.
That's it. That's where we got some of those names.
Uh-huh.
And these fellas, take George Washington. He comes up here and he sleeps in the bed. And we can actually say that George Washington slept in that bed.
Here we see the actual bed that George Washington slept in.
That's right. This George Washington is an 11-year-old kid from Skaneateles, New York.
Here at the Fertnell Antique Factory in Fertnell, Connecticut. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, sir, and I'm sure we've learned something.
I hope so, and it's always a pleasure to have you come by here from your great radio program.
I hope so. This is Wally Ballou returning you to Bob and Ray.
And now the Kumquat Institute of America invites you to spend another educational session with the idol of the nation's youngsters, Mr. Science. As we look in on the modern, well-equipped laboratory today, we see the little Jimmy Schwab is just arriving to watch Mr. Science perform his latest fascinating experiment.
Oh, there, Jimmy. You're just in time to watch me perform my latest fascinating experiment.
Holy Ned, Mr. Science. I was afraid I was going to be late. That radio you built for me to wear inside my cap is such a high antenna that I couldn't get through the 12th Street underpass. I had to run clear down at the 8th Street viaduct.
Well, a long antenna ensures good reception, Jimmy.
Gosh, all hemlock, Mr. Science. I'm not complaining. I pick up wonderful stuff on the shortwave band. Now, the thing does sit kind of heavy on my skull. It must weigh 40 or 50 pounds.
Yes, well, it has 16 tubes, Jerry. Maybe I can make a metal brace to shift some of the weight to your shoulders.
Glorioski, Mr. Science. That would be wonderful. Then I wouldn't have those terrible headaches all the time.
Well, we'll see what we can do after the program. Now I want to show you a fascinating experiment that will prove how fire cannot exist without oxygen.
Great day in the morning, Mr. Science. How can you prove that?
Well, it's really quite simple, Jimmy. First, I take this device known as a match and touch it to the wick of this other thing.
Criminatlys, Mr. Science. What's that other thing called?
The other thing is called a candle, Jimmy.
Leaping lizards, Mr. Science. Well, like dollar kids at school, I've seen one of those.
Now, just try to contain yourself, son. You see how the candle is ignited from the match? Then we place a bell jar over the candle. There, the fire gradually uses up the oxygen inside the bell jar. A vacuum is created, causing the flame to gradually be extinguished.
Gee willikers, Mr. Science. I don't know what you're talking about.
The principle we've demonstrated, Jimmy, is the key to all firefighting. That's why we throw sand on flames, to smother the source of oxygen. Here, I'll light the candle again, but this time, I will cause the fire to go out by piling sand on it.
Jumping Jehoshaphat, Mr. Science. I can hardly wait to see that.
Now, let's see. I think I put that sack of sand over on the workbench here.
Golly Moses, Mr. Science. The candle has caught the drink on fire.
Well, the sand will extinguish that in no time. See, I just throw the sand at the flame.
Glory be, Mr. Science. Now the floor's on fire, too.
Sand is excellent for extinguishing any fire.
Oh, jumping Jiminy, Mr. Science. The whole place is going up like a cinder block.
This is a lot of sand in one of the other studios.
Has been brought to you by the Kumquat Institute of America. Today's program was the last of our current series. Say, you know, during the past few weeks, the Bob and Ray organization has reached out all over the country searching for people with unusual occupations to interview. And in our nationwide search, we overlooked a gentleman who has perhaps an unusual an occupation as anybody we've ever heard of.
Well, the oversight occurred because this chap works for Mutual Television, and it just happened that we never ran across him. Yeah, but he's here at the microphone with us now, and his name, I believe, is Rudolph Megacycle. I think you said you're in TV engineering. Is that right, Rudy?
That's right. My job is really independent of any department, but the accounting department has put me in TV engineering just to keep their books straight.
Well, now, I wonder if you'd tell our listeners just what your job is, Mr. Megacycle.
Well, I'm responsible for that little round glow that you see for a few seconds on your TV screen after you've turned the set off.
Well, you mean that little pinpoint of light that stays on after the picture's faded out, is that it?
That's right. Well, it's not really a pinpoint of light. It's a hexagonal in shape, actually.
Hexagonal?
Yes, but it's so small that it probably appears to the layman to be round.
Well, yes, it does. I had no idea that the afterglow was supplied by the network. I thought the picture tube just, well, gave off that little light automatically as it was cooling off.
I bet you believe in elves and brownies, too.
No, somebody just told me that one time.
Well, a lot of superstitious stories have been told about the little light that glows after you turn the set off, but the truth of the matter is that it's a public service provided by Mutual. At a cost of approximately $19 million a year.
Boy, well, why is it so expensive just to create that little tiny light?
Well, it's expensive because people don't all turn their sets off at the same time. We have to have regional offices all over the country, and every one of them is equipped with a mammoth control panel, having a separate switch for each TV set in their particular area.
Well, and you mean this glow light is turned on manually for every television set in the country?
Yes, there's no other way to do it. When you turn off your set, a buzzer sounds in the regional office. One of our workers then runs over to the control panel and flips the switch that turns on your glow.
And maintaining this elaborate network costs $19 million a year, does it?
That's right. Now, we've tried on various occasions to get sponsors interested in buying the glow.
There isn't room on the little dot for a visual message, but we figure that a voice could just come in and say this glow is being brought to you by so-and-so.
Well, you haven't been able to sell it yet, I guess, huh?
No, however, we do have one client who has signed up to buy a pale orange glow just as soon as color TV comes into wider use. Color is opening a whole new world to those of us in glow.
Well, you seem almost to be glowing yourself as you talk about it, Mr. Megacycle.
Well, I had a couple of quick ones on the way up, yeah.
Well, thanks very much for being with us on the air today, and it's nice to find this other side. Thanks.
Well, that's about it for now. We'll be back, though, in a little while with some more really funny entertainment for you folks.
Right.
Yes. Oh. Holmes will have to come later. Wally Blue has just called. He has an exclusive story somewhere here in the huge, bustling city of New York. Come in, please. Wally Blue.
Sitting here at the heart of Times Square with my portable microphone and investigating a crowd which has gathered and trying to get the eyewitness story to the event, someone who saw it happen. Sir, you seem to be here the longest. I wonder if you'd tell me just how it happened.
Well, I saw a crowd of people. I was walking along.
You're just walking along the street, minding your own business, were you?
That's right. I saw the crowd, and I said, well, I had a few minutes to spare.
Uh-huh.
So I went right over, and here I am. And
wonderful.
I'm
well,
fine of the crowd. Now,
yeah.
What was
it you saw happening, that you saw happen that you could describe for us?
Well, you see, I was on my way.
You're walking down the street, as I understand the story.
I was walking
south.
Now,
tell it your own words from there.
I was walking south on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
Then I saw the crowd of people. Well, first I saw this big truck pull up.
Yeah.
See, then I saw you hop out.
Oh.
And then I saw another fellow hop out with a black suitcase. And he plugged a wire into it. And
Have been the engineer getting ready for me to do this remote broadcast covering this event.
Then I saw you take your microphone, and you started to talk into it.
Uh-huh.
So you were testing.
Yes, I did, just before I went on the air.
And then, that's why I came right over to see what you were doing.
I see. Well, then,
curious about it.
You didn't really see anything happen. It was this crowd gathered around me that you saw, I guess.
I guess so.
Well, it's a false alarm, fellows, back there. Unfortunately.
This is one of the Finley Quality Networkers.
Marty, I'm picking you up. My microphone.
Here, I think I'll get out of here.
Marty, sir. I'm Sherma Horn.
Sir, I wonder if you can tell us what brought you here.
Well, he's going to interview the man I just talked to. He'll certainly be surprised when he discovers that there wasn't anything.
This truck, you say, yeah? And had to
We're picking him up.
Finley Quality Network, Lars?
Mentioning the network.
I had an excellent...
Sorry, Bob and Ray. There was no story after all. This is Wally Ballou returning it now.
This is Finley Quality Network.
Here in the basement workshop of Fred Salvi, the do-it-yourselfer. Fred, could you turn that thing off for a minute while I give the introduction?
Yeah. I'm finished anyway. It's a little gasoline turbine device I've rigged up to open the garage doors for the wife when she drives the car in.
Just another example of better living by doing it yourself, huh, Fred?
Yes, it's just another example of better living by doing it yourself.
Well, you put it a little better. Well, what example of home craftsmanship have you chosen to pass along to the handyman in our audience this week, Fred?
Well, this week, Bob and Ray, I'm going to demonstrate how to make iodine.
Mm.
Item that's found in the medicine chest of almost every American home.
Well, I certainly had no idea that iodine could be made in the average basement workshop.
Well, I don't think many do-it-yourselfers realize that it can be done, but actually all you need is a little extra equipment for rendering the ashes from kelp.
The ashes from what?
From kelp.
Kelp.
You get iodine out of kelp.
You mean seaweed?
It's a type of seaweed, yes. And for iodine production, the best kelp comes from the Pacific coast.
Gee, it must be pretty expensive to have it shipped here, isn't it?
No, not if you buy the kelp in carload lots and have it pushed off onto your own railroad siding. So, of course, that's the first step in the home production of iodine, to lay the roadbed and tracks for a railroad siding.
And then from this basement full of kelp that you have here, I'd assume that you've already taken care of that first step.
Yeah, I spent most of the week laying the tracks, and even after buying up the rights to run them across several of my neighbor's property, I found that the whole project cost me less than $4,000.
And the siding allows you now to bring the kelp right up to your cellar door.
Yes, and then I lower it right down through the basement window into this copper kelp burner.
And from the smell in here, I'd assume that you've already burned the batch for the demonstration.
Yes, you burn about a ton and a half of kelp to get this 10-pound residue of ashes.
Hmm.
Then we put the ashes into this hydraulic press for rendering.
Gee whiz, that hydraulic press is an expensive-looking piece of equipment.
Cost about $1,200. But, of course, I can run it with the same gasoline turbine that opens the garage door, so there's no additional cost there, you see.
I see. Well, now, I notice that you're placing a bottle under the press. Is that to catch the iodine?
Yes, you'll see the finished product come right out at the bottom there.
And there it is, almost a quarter of a bottle of pure iodine, and produced, I suppose, at a fraction of what it would cost you in a drugstore.
Well, I don't know what you'd pay for it in a drugstore. It cost me about $200 a bottle this way, the way I figured it down.
But you've done it yourself. And so, once again, we've seen an example of better living by doing it yourself. From the basement workshop of Fred Faldi, the do-it-yourself.
I'll open the garage door for you.
I left the car out front.
Now, important news about fast relief for cold misery.
Hey, that's right. That kind of news is always important, especially when it comes from tablets.
Meet lovely Hollywood star, Emil Quinlan.
Hello. All this in motion pictures simply dread cold. Imagine trying to give a top performance with head and body aching and that awful feverish feeling. I have to fight cold miseries fast.
How do you do that, Miss Emil?
At the first sign of a cold, I take tablets. The fast way to relieve cold distress, even of nasty virus colds.
You're right. Clinical tests of all the leading tablets proved fastest acting. In minutes, exclusive formula speeds wonderful pain reliever into your bloodstream and all through your body. In the same time, the other leading brands showed no trace of pain-relieving medicines. None of the other leading cold tablets started so fast to relieve all these cold miseries.
Relieves muscular pain, headache.
Reduces fever.
Calms upset stomach.
Also overcomes irregularity. Get tablets today, the fast way to relieve those nasty cold miseries so you begin to feel better right away.
Sire, for the public service feature, Speak Your Mind. And here once again to help our listeners with their mental and emotional problems is the eminent New York psychiatrist, Dr. Rufus Llewellyn Hume. Now, what is that thing you strapped on your back there, Doctor? It looks like a parachute.
Yes, it is a parachute. I feel a lot more comfortable wearing one of these when I'm up in one of these big office buildings. If the thing should suddenly collapse, I figure that, well, I could just bail out.
Well, I don't think a big modern building like this has ever collapsed, has it?
I don't have the statistics, Mr. Goulding. I just have the phobia.
I see. Well, suppose we move right along now to this week's mail.
Yes.
Our first letter comes from a man in Fredonia, New York. He writes, I'm sure that my dog, Frederick, can understand everything I say. As a result, I'm hesitant to discuss any personal affairs with my wife because I'm afraid that Frederick will blab them all over town.
Yes.
Now, how can I overcome this fear?
Well, the easiest solution would be to hold off any personal discussions until after the dog has gone to bed. If this isn't possible, I'd suggest that the man and his wife learn to converse in some foreign language that the dog doesn't understand.
Very well.
Yes.
Here's one from a lady in Waco, Texas.
Do you hear the sound of ice cubes clinking in glasses?
No, I don't.
If you're having a party around here someplace and don't want to invite me, you can just say so.
Well, we're not having any party, Doctor. It's probably just those things that you keep hearing.
Yes.
About this lady in Texas, she writes, the main highway leading west out of Waco has been closed for repair work. I keep fearing that they'll close it on the other side of town, too, and that we'll all be trapped here. My husband says that I'm nutty as a fruitcake, but I know this is a real danger. What should I do? Doctor?
You know, it's awfully hard for me to concentrate with those people laughing and whooping it up at the party that way. Can't you get them to hold it down a little bit? You're on the radio, after all.
Oh, Doctor, there's no party going on in here. Now, what advice do you have for that woman?
Get out of town while the road is still open.
All right, here's one from a man in Bessemer, Alabama. He writes, I never have any trouble remembering birthdays and anniversaries, but every year I forget Christmas.
Ew.
I just did it again, and I'm very embarrassed. What can I do to improve my memory of it?
Wait a minute. Listen.
Well, I don't hear anything.
Well, I do. They're starting to play charades at the party. I want to get in on that.
You've been listening to the public service program Speak Your Mind. Our guest speaker was the eminent New York psychiatrist, Dr. Rupert Llewellyn Hume. Dr. Hume will be with us next time. Hope you will be, too, when he solves more of the mental and emotional problems confronting our listeners.
We're lucky because we do have one or two of them here.
Well, there's just one, really. This gentleman is with me.
I see.
I'm the only one you're supposed to interview. At least that's what that young lady told me.
Well, now, what is your name, ma'am?
Well, my real name is Lottie Crump, but I'm known professionally as Mrs. Wingate C. Bellingham. I prefer you call me that.
Okay, well, now, what is this unusual occupation of yours, Mrs. Bellingham?
I'm a shill in a supermarket.
I'm afraid I don't quite understand.
Well, I go into a supermarket wearing this mink coat and all this jewelry, and the other women think I'm a society leader or something.
I see.
When they see me putting certain items in my cart, they naturally pick out the same things.
Oh, in other words, they assume that a woman of your standing would only buy the very best. Is
that
right?
Right. Of course, I'm actually working for the management. The stuff I put in my cart is a lot of junk the store's trying to get rid of.
Well, is that all you do all day? Just walk around the store putting a lot of low-quality groceries in your shopping cart?
Oh, my, no. I have to keep doing things to attract attention to myself. For example, I'll go up to one of the clerks and say, I do hope you handle number 2 cans of Stengel's Early June Peas. They're the only brand that my husband, Wingate C. Bellingham, the wealthy Wall Street tycoon, will eat.
Oh, well, then I can see the other women hear that, and they make a dash for Stengel's Early June Peas, huh?
And sakes, yes, they knock each other down to get to them. They get so worked up, they don't even notice that the cans fell off the truck and are all squashed.
Well, don't the other women ever suspect that you really work for the store? I should think they'd get
wild. Well, now, they give me a fishy look sometimes when they see me sneaking in the side door and putting the stuff back on the shelves, but they never say anything.
Uh-huh. Well, now, what about this gentleman here with you? Is he your accomplice?
No, his name is Rudolph Zimmerman.
Oh, nice to know you, Mr. Zimmerman. What do you do for a living?
I don't do nothing.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for chatting with us, Mrs. Bellingham. We've certainly enjoyed hearing about your unusual occupation.
Well, I've enjoyed being here, and if you're over in a certain market on Lexington Avenue this weekend, don't buy the veal cutlets. I'll be pushing them, but they're rancid.
All right, well, we'll remember that. We'll get the name after you leave the air. Thanks again, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
You can go too, Mr. Zimmerman.
Okay.
Wally Ballou is visiting an atomic energy plant in Marshalltown, Iowa. So if you're ready with your report, come in, please, Wally Ballou.
Lou at the Ajax Atomic Energy Company in Marshalltown, Iowa, and with me at the microphone is the president of the firm, Mr. Herschel Pitgrab. Now, as I understand it, Mr. Pitgrab, this is the only atomic energy plant in the country that has no connection whatsoever with the government.
That's
that
correct,
right,
Mr. Ballou?
Uh-huh.
Our firm is strictly private enterprise selling to the general public. For example, we put out a very serviceable atomic bomb that anybody can buy for $79.50.
Well, do you sell many bombs?
Sell quite a few of them, yes. We have the field pretty much to ourselves. The government atomic plants won't sell bombs.
I know
that. That means that if you want to buy one, you almost have to come to us.
I was a little bit surprised that the government would allow you to operate a plant like this. Seems to me to be kind of a menace to...
Well, there really isn't much the government can do about it. They won't let me ship any of them to customers overseas. There's nothing anybody can do to keep me from selling the bombs to people in this country.
Well, now, we're standing here in the main production room of your plant, and I don't see any cyclotrons or atomic reactors or anything like that. Do you have those things over to another building or what?
No, we don't use any of that complicated stuff here. That's how we're able to keep the price of our bombs down within reach of the average consumer.
Well, if you don't have any of the usual equipment, how are you able to create atomic energy?
Well, you take some of this pink stuff here and then some of this brown stuff. Well, then you mix them together and let them sit in an earthenware crock for about a week.
Uh-huh.
And that's about all there is to it. Of course, you have to pour the whole business into a bomb casing and then put a fuse on it, but that runs the price up.
Well, now, those two ingredients must be pretty powerful to set up an atomic reaction, I should think.
The pink stuff is ethyl gasoline, and the brown stuff is a popular cola drink.
Then you could really make an atomic bomb that way?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised myself until I tested the first one and blew a crater about 60 feet deep and about a half a mile wide with it.
How about that? Sounds as if one of them went off there.
Yes, just the fellows in the testing department clowning around down there.
Well, it's been very nice to talk to you, Mr. Pitgrab.
Oh, it's been nice having you out here, sir. And you're going to drop back a little later in the fall. We'll have our Christmas gift line in full production by then.
We'll try to do that. Until the next time, this is Wally Ballou at Marshalltown, Iowa, sending it back to Bob and Ray in New York.
Come on, you guys.
Hey, cut it off. Cut off the foolishness, fellas. Get back to the job.
We just got word this morning that
The young lady who was recently crowned Miss McCracken County, Kentucky, is here in New York for a visit, and we invited her to drop by for a short interview. I think your name is Miss Wilma Gathorpe. Is that correct?
Well, it's just pronounced Thorpe, but G on the front is silent.
I see. Well, now, who are all these people you've brought with you today sitting over there in the peanut gallery?
Well, they're my kinfolk. I won this trip to New York for being chosen as Miss McCracken County.
Mm-hmm.
My family was afraid of me to come up here alone, so they all drove up with me from down home.
Quite a bunch of them over there, isn't there?
27 of them made the trip altogether.
Well, it's nice to have all of you folks here with us today. And getting back to your selection as Miss McCracken County, I'm kind of surprised to see that you're as old a woman as you are. I mean, when you mention beauty contest winners, you usually think of young girls.
Well, I don't think that's a very nice thing to say. I came all the way down from my hotel in Yonkers just for this interview, and I certainly wouldn't have done it if I had known that you were going to start off by insulting
me. Well, I didn't mean the insulting, Miss Thorpe. It was just an observation I couldn't help making. Say you're staying at a hotel in Yonkers?
Yes, the Chamber of Commerce back home made the reservations. I don't know why they put us in a hotel so far out. There really isn't much to do up there except go to a neighborhood movie.
Yes? You say you won this trip as your prize for being chosen in Miss McCracken County, huh?
That's right. I got the trip and a power lawnmower. I didn't bring the lawnmower with me, though.
I guess there was no age limit in the beauty contest you won, huh?
Well, now, there you go again.
Oh, I'm sorry. But you just seem a little old to win a beauty contest. I can't...
Well, I was a couple of years older than most of the other girls in the contest.
Just a couple of years older?
Well, I don't know exactly. Maybe 20, 25 years, something like that.
You wore a bathing suit in this contest?
Yes, we all wore bathing suits. I wore a bathing cap, too. I think I was the only one who wore a bathing cap.
I'm just wondering how you'd look in a bathing suit. You're pretty fat. Obese.
Now, see here. I don't have to stand for comments like that.
Well, you must weigh over 200 pounds. You can't get over that. I just don't see how you could ever win a beauty contest.
Well, look here. I don't like the way you're talking to me at all.
I don't like it either.
I know, but she's so fat.
I think you better mind your manners, Pally.
Blemishes
on
her face there.
Well, I'll fix you, pal.
Now, you folks, don't form a circle around me here. We just have to report on things as we see them.
You all in Claflin, I'll see you some
Hey, ow! Oh. Hey!
Well, here from the Montpelier Observatory is Professor Rumson X. Smalley, who last week had rather an unusual experience out there. Dr. Smalley, or Professor Smalley, welcome to the Bob and Ray Show. Last Friday was the day that Mars made its closest approach to the Earth for some, I don't know, how many hundreds of thousands of years?
Well, that's the closest it's been for almost 200,000 years.
And it'll be another 200,000?
It'll be 276,000 years until Mars will be as close to Earth as it was last Friday.
Well, I guess then none of us being around at that time.
Thursday.
Was it last Thursday?
Yes. Well, Friday morning was Thursday night.
Yeah. How about telling us what preparations you made to see Mars at its close approach there last week?
Well, this other scientist and myself went up to the observatory, and we brought our secretaries so that they could write down any observations that we made.
Uh-huh. Was it a good night? Was the weather clear and visibility good?
Well, we got to laughing and kidding around there in the observatory, the other professor and the two secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't pay too much attention to Mars.
In other words, the observations that you were to give the secretaries to take down in shorthand, you dispensed with, is that right?
That's right, and we more or less had a little party, had a record player there. We had refreshments and little sandwiches, and it was very successful. We're going to get together like that every Thursday night, whether there's anything going on up above or not.
Thank you very much, Professor Rumson K. X. Smalley. And, well, when's the next eclipse? Is that going to come off pretty soon, this winter, maybe?
Oh, I suppose it'll be an eclipse. And we'll try to make it and
sure
see if everything goes okay.
See if you can come down here and give us a report.
We had quite a time, though. It worked out very well.
I can well imagine. Thank you very much.
You're entirely welcome.
Giving us a scientific report.
We'll have a word from Roy Rogers in just 10 seconds.
from Roy Rogers. This is Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your phone.
Reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your phone.